Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and out there in the World Wide Web. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. Speaking of the World Wide Web, I'm wondering when we're going to get our first international listener to the show, because you can listen to the show via the web anywhere in the world if you're willing to get up at the proper time, I suppose. Well, anyway, I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and I have with me this morning Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland, and our regular commentator, Phil Duffy, is taking a vacation. Now, last week we looked at the subject of when governments take, and we specifically focused on the final clause of the Fifth Amendment, which places some restrictions on it. What it presupposes is a power of the government called eminent domain, a power that the government has and governments have had for a long, long time to take your private property when it's needed for public use. And sometimes, well, before the Constitution, governments would do this at a whim without compensating you necessarily for the privilege of taking your property. But the Fifth Amendment then placed the restriction that government could only do this, our government could only do this, when there was a public use and when you had been justly compensated. Last week we talked about how the Supreme Court has created wiggle room in both those phrases. What is public use? So they've determined that now it's better interpreted as public benefit. And what is just compensation? Does it have to be market-driven, et cetera? So we had a couple callers, first-time callers last week, and so I'm down two pocket constitutions, so that's just great. But last week, one of our callers asked about taxes, whether taxes were in fact a proper taking of private property and a constitutional property. Well, a constitutional taking. So are taxes legitimate taking by the government? Well, we're going to explore that today. And it was too expansive a topic to cover last week, so we've devoted the whole show to it this week. And we'll be taking your calls later in the show, and I encourage you to call in. Everybody is affected by this topic. Everybody is wage earning is affected by this topic. So everybody has some skin in the game on taxes almost. The primary call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. And if the primary number is busy, as it often is, we have alternate numbers, 610-539-1783 and 1784. Those are two very important years in our country, and we'll be talking about those 2 years later on in the show. All first-time callers, such as our two gentlemen from last week, receive in the mail a nifty pocket constitution. So if you are a first-time caller, when you call in and the receptionist takes your information, make sure you give them your mailing address so we can get you that constitution. So let's get started, as we usually do, by examining what the Constitution has to say about this topic, but I'm going to put it in our historical context by talking about what happened first. We generally think that the independence, war for independence, was fought over taxes and tea, and really that was an important part of it, but not the only part. And we commonly think of the Boston Tea Party on the 16th of December 1773 as really the catalytic event in our nation's history that led ultimately to our declaring independence. A lot of people don't realize that the Boston Tea Party was only one of many. It was the first, but it was only one of many tea parties that took place in the colonies at that time. And a man named Joseph Cummings has written an interesting little book called 10 Tea Parties, Patriotic Protests That History Forgot. And in that, he outlines not only the Boston Tea Party, but he discusses ones that took place at Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Charleston, South Carolina, New York City, Chesterton, Maryland, Annapolis, Maryland, York, Pennsylvania. All up and down the colonies, tea parties or tea protests were taking place. And some of them were not as benign as the Boston Tea Party even. There were ships that were set aflame and burned to the water edge and all sorts of events. So it's a very interesting topic, and I encourage you to get a copy of Cummings' book if you're interested in more on that. Now, a lot of people think that taxing without representation was the chief reason for the Revolution. But if you look at the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson lists imposing taxes on us without our consent, his words, as number 17 out of 27 complaints. So it was only one out of 27 complaints. I don't know what the percentage of that works out to be, but it was only one of many complaints that led to the War of Independence and our declaring independence. So we did. We declared independence. We formed a confederacy under the Articles of Confederation. But those students of history will remember that the Articles of Confederation were quite inadequate, and then their deficiencies became apparent very quickly. One of the chief deficiencies was it did not give the Continental Congress or the Confederation Congress the ability to tax the states. They could only ask for contributions. And whether the states came up with those contributions or not was up to the states. There was no enforcement mechanism for ensuring that those contributions flowed into the Confederation Treasury. And so that imposed a hardship on their ability to conduct the war. And the problems were apparent from the outset. General Washington had difficulty paying his troops and feeding his troops and clothing his troops. No more better example than Valley Forge, right there where the show originates. Nearly 2,000 Continental or Colonial soldiers died from starvation and exposure. More than 200 officers resigned their commissions because this was a debacle. The Congress could not pay its army. Our Congress responded by printing nearly worthless paper money, leading to the slogan, "A wagon load of money will not buy a wagon load of goods." So the Congress did whatever it could do, but it proved to be very inadequate. And then in March of 1783, we had the famous Newburgh Mutiny, where a group of Continental Army officers camped in Newburgh, New York, composed a fiery letter to Congress. They complained of no pay and failure to settle food and clothing accounts, and they threatened to take their army and move out west and leave the colonies undefended. Just a month or two later, in June, we had the Pennsylvania troops mutiny and march on Congress in Philadelphia. Congress knew they were coming, or was told they were coming, fled to Princeton. At Princeton, John Dickinson, then the president of the Congress, was asked, "Do you want the New Jersey militia to protect you?" And he said, "Well, I don't know whether I can trust them either." So Congress moved further south to Annapolis, where they stayed for quite a while. So we had this problem under the Articles of Confederation. The Congress could not raise funds to do what was necessary. And, of course, we know that got they got fixed eventually in the Constitution. But things even got worse. After the war was over and the impetus of providing the war effort was over, in April of 1786, Rufus King wrote a letter to Elbridge Gerry saying, "We are without money or the prospect of it in the federal treasury. And the states, many of them, care so little about the Union that they take no measures to keep a representation in Congress. So it was a problem that had to be solved, and it was solved at the 1787 convention in Philadelphia, and now we have several provisions in the Constitution that we'll talk about in just a moment. Let's be clear. As long as there is to be government, government which provides legitimate constitutional services and which keeps its citizens safe from attack, that government requires some sort of revenue. In the Virginia Ratifying Convention of June 1788, Edmund Randolph says, "Money is the nerve, the life, and the soul of a government." So, yes, money is necessary, taxes are necessary of some sort or another. But here's the rub. If taxes are unavoidable, how much revenue does a government actually need to perform its constitutional duties? When a government adds unconstitutional duties or programs or agencies, do we, the people, have an obligation to fund it? What form of taxes are proper and constitutional? We'll see that in a moment. What is the proper level of taxation? We'll see how that's been abused. How and from whom are taxes to be collected? And then we have this added feature of taxation, best expressed in Thomas Jefferson's words in the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. He says, "To compel a man to furnish contributions of money, that is taxes, for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical." So conscientious objectors in this country are contributing through their taxes to war. Is that right? Is that proper? We have we are funding Planned Parenthood with public funds, and that is leading, obviously, to the abortion of, so far, 51 million unborn babies. Is that a proper use of tax funding? Our government is bloated and wasteful. There's an estimated $1 trillion in wasteful spending each year. And when we look at a $1 trillion deficit, that really makes it drives the point home. If you want a real eye-opener, Google the phrase, 30 stupid things the government is spending money on. And number one was the $750,000 soccer field we put in for our detainees at Guantanamo Bay. These men who want nothing more than to kill all Americans, we're going to make sure that they're physically fit. So great, great use of money there. We spent $175,000, the government did, to determine if cocaine makes Japanese quail engage in sexually risky behavior. Wonderful. And then we spent $200,000 on a tattoo removal program out in Mission Hills, California. Great use of money. If you want to read more on this, Senator Tom Coburn, who is now retired, wrote each year what he called his annual pig book. And you can still find these out on the Internet. You can download them in PDF form, and they will be a real eye-opening experience for you to see what your government is spending money on. So let's take a quick look at what the Constitution does give the Congress the ability to do. In Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, it states the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So there's an ability to raise taxes in order to do two things: pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. That's the only reason that those taxes are there. Now, the Supreme Court has made this general welfare clause into a omnibus grant of power. And so now that the feeling is, the court has said that taxes could be raised for any purpose whatsoever, that anything is affecting the general or improving the general welfare of the United States. And that's a very different interpretation than we began under the Constitution. Article 1, Section 9 states that the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation. So we're talking about the slave trade, and Congress had the ability to put a tax or duty on slaves who are imported to the states. The next provision, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration. So if Virginia had 15% of the population, then they were assessed 15% of the total tax to be collected. And then finally, no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. So that's the way we have it in the Constitution. I'm going to turn now to Pastor David Whitney to let us hear his take on this whole taxation situation. David, what do you think? Is our taxes really that necessary, and are they being properly administered in this country?
Well, thank you, Gary. Well, yes, of course, taxes are necessary for a government to accomplish its limited functions, and we need to recall what those limited functions are in the eyes of our founders, as declared in the Declaration of Independence. There is a Creator God. Secondly, our rights come from Him. And thirdly, the only purpose of civil government in the Declaration of Independence states that it is to secure and protect those God-given rights, not to study the sexual habits of some creatures in, what was it, Japan or ridiculous things like that. So if we were to restrain the taxing power of government to the original purposes for which civil government exists, we can be certain that the taxing of the American people would be much smaller than it is. And it's important to note all the restrictions that you just listed there on the taxing powers of the federal government. Yes, they could do duties and ex posts and so on, but they could not do capitation taxes, which is a tax directly upon the head of an individual citizen. They could not reach out and touch your pocketbook and take money directly from you as an individual. And when people hear that, they say, wait a minute, isn't that really what the IRS is doing? Every paycheck I receive, they reach out and take it personally out of my pay before I even see the money. The IRS gets it. Well, yes, exactly. And so the question is, well, how in the world did that happen? Because it's very clear the prohibition on capitation taxes there in Article 1, Section 9. And the usual argument given is, well, the 16th Amendment amended the taxing powers of the United States and enabled them to reach out and touch you in that way the IRS does today. But that neglects the real truth about the 16th Amendment, because its original purpose, if we trace back what took place leading up to the 16th Amendment, it was an attempt on the part of those in Washington to break the trusts. These were powerful monopolies. Monopolies were illegal, but trusts were established where those who were behind the trust, that is kind of behind the wall that couldn't be seen publicly, were gaining profit from an essential monopoly. They had constructed a monopoly but hidden its powers through these trusts. And many of the antitrust provisions, such as the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, were designed to break those trusts. And one of the ways they realized they could expose what those trusts were about was to force those corporations to open their books to the federal government. So the federal government could look and see, oh, okay, money's going here and there, and they could draw the lines back, and they could expose these illegal trusts, because after the Sherman Antitrust Act, they were illegal, but they were hidden. So it was only possible to bring them to light through forcing these corporations to open their books. So what Congress did is they enacted, in 1894, an income tax on corporations alone. And it wasn't that the federal government needed the money. That wasn't the point of it, which might sound amazing considering how voracious our federal government is today. It wasn't that they needed the money. They needed the information. And by this corporate income tax that Congress passed and was signed by the president, they could force the corporations to open their books, expose these illegal trusts, and then therefore they could bust these trusts in court. However, in 1895, the Supreme Court, in a case Pollard v. Farmers and Loan Trust Company, in that Supreme Court decision, they declared that this corporate income tax passed by the Congress was unconstitutional, and it's interesting to note why. It was unconstitutional because it imposed a tax on income derived from property, and that, they said, was a violation of the constitutional restrictions forbidding direct taxation in the Constitution. You might say, well, that's not capitation. But I believe the Supreme Court was correct in that decision. because it was a tax not based proportionally, as we've already stated, that if the government's going to tax you directly, it can only do it proportionally. That is, they can't send the tax bill to you, individual Joe citizen. They have to send the tax bill to your state, the state of Maryland. And based upon the census, how many people are in the state of Maryland versus how many people are in the other states, your state is going to receive a proportion of the total federal tax bill, and that's what your state is responsible to pay the federal government. So, for example, Maryland has, say, $5 million, and, oh, I pick Indiana, maybe $10 million. Indiana would receive a tax bill twice the size of that Maryland received, and both states got to choose how they were going to raise that revenue. Say, well, some states might say we're going to have a sales tax and going to tax all goods purchased, or others we're going to have an income tax. I don't believe that's the best means of doing it, but whatever the states chose, the states would determine how that tax was going to be raised. There would be no federal tax agency coming after an individual citizen. That's illegal. That's a violation of Article 1, Section 9. So when the Supreme Court said, yep, your decision there is unconstitutional, that law, although its intention might be to bust the trust, it is unconstitutional. Well, that required then a pushback, and President William Howard Taft, in his message to Congress June 16, 1909, expressly stated that the purpose of his proposed 16th Amendment would be to get and run around the Supreme Court decision, in other words, permit the taxation of corporations. In other words, say, okay, we can't do this to citizens, but we can tax corporations, and so the Supreme Court ruling then would no longer hold because of an amendment to the Constitution that allowed the federal government to do what it could not do prior to the 16th Amendment. But notice, its purpose was only to tax corporations. The whole purpose behind this was to bust the trusts, and individual citizens were not the target of this tax. In fact, the tax specifically, as it's crafted in the 16th Amendment, has no way in which it can reach out and tax the citizens themselves. And so after the ratification, we can talk about that maybe after the break, the so-called ratification of the 16th Amendment, it's interesting that the Supreme Court made those statements explicitly clear, that the Supreme Court said that there was no new taxing powers granted to the federal government by the 16th Amendment. In other words, the 16th Amendment only affected corporations. It did not affect individual citizens, and individual citizens were not to be taxed in spite of the 16th Amendment coming about. And by the way, I ought to pause at this point when I'm teaching this portion of the class. I want to tell folks, I am not giving anyone any tax advice whatsoever. I am not telling people how or what they ought to do in terms of filling out any form whatsoever. I'm simply teaching the history of what has taken place in terms of this amendment and the taxing powers of the federal government, teaching what the Constitution said, how it was properly interpreted, and how I believe it has been improperly interpreted following the ratification of the 16th Amendment. I'm not advising anyone to do anything. I have friends who have made certain decisions regarding all those that have actually spent time in prison, federal prison, because of it. I'm not advocating for or against any of that. In other words, I'm not giving anybody tax advice. I'm just saying this is what the history is, and I know that when I teach this, many people get sort of frustrated at the whole thing and say, well, wait a minute, if we're not to be taxed directly by the IRS, and the Constitution says that, and the 16th Amendment has been falsely interpreted to say that they can tax us, what are we to do? And my recommendation is that you communicate this to your representatives in Congress and say, you need to change what the IRS is doing, and Congress has the power to do that. You need to shut down their functions. They can continue to tax corporations. That's legitimate, but taxing individuals is really a violation of the protections we are afforded by our Constitution.
Yeah, well, I will get into that 16th Amendment a little bit more after the break. Thanks for bringing it up. And get your questions and comments ready, because we're going to have you to call in. So see you after these words on We the People, the Constitution Matters.
for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. With a Senate vote after 3 in the morning, Congress sends a 2-year budget bill to President Obama's desk. There's more money for the military.
The men and women who are fighting this war need every dollar we can send to them. I don't want to go into battle without being well equipped.
Republican Lindsey Graham voted yes. It was a no from another presidential candidate, Rand Paul.
What this bill shows is it's really the fault of both parties. There is an unholy alliance in Washington between right and left, frankly.
Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio were also among 35 senators voting against the bill. Executed by lethal injection in Florida, Jerry Correll, convicted of stabbing his wife, 5-year-old daughter, and 2 in-laws to death in 1985. The execution was supposed to be in February. It was delayed by a legal fight over the sedative used. Fox News. We report. You decide.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mention WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
We the People t-shirts, where freedom is always in style. Famous quotes from patriots throughout U.S. history printed on the back of our t-shirts. We do over 25 quotes in a variety of colors. High-quality t-shirts with a meaningful message that make people think. Encourage others by reminding them about patriots of conviction who have gone before us. Order directly from wethepeopletshirts.us. For more information, call 757-645-8878.
I am for freedom of the press and against all violations of the Constitution to silence by force and not by reason the complaints or criticisms, just or unjust, of our citizens against the conduct of their agents. Thomas Jefferson, 1799.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters, and we're talking today about a topic near and dear to many of us in this country, taxation. Get your questions and comments ready. We're going to be able to take some calls in a few minutes. The calling number is 610-539-TALK, that's 610-539-8255. Or 610-539-1783-1784. Now, David, before the break, mentioned that there was some problems with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, and a lot of people contend that it was never ratified completely. If you want to hear all the gory details, there's a book by Bill Benson called The Law That Never Was, and he goes through in excruciating detail to show you how that 16th Amendment was improperly ratified by the states. There were states that were recorded as having ratified it when they didn't, and vice versa, and the whole thing is a mess. And unfortunately, a lot of people have taken that idea that the 16th was not properly ratified into court with them, and unfortunately they have lost every time because the court is not willing to hear that argument. The court contends that since the Constitution does not itself define what a proper ratification amounts to, that it is a question that Congress must resolve, and Congress, in the case of the 16th, accepted at face value the words of Secretary of State Philander Knox that everything was hunky-dory, that all the ratifications had, in fact, happened properly. So that's, in the court's eyes, that's the end of the story. So, but it's an interesting read, nevertheless, and it does talk about a very important topic. How do you ratify a constitutional amendment? How is it, should we have some proper procedures? And that's a topic for another day, but it's still an important topic that we need to address. Another book I want to bring to our listeners' attention is by Peter Eric Hendrickson called Cracking the Code, The Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America. That is a very complicated book, but it's also a book that contends that basically most of us who are paying taxes based on wages are doing so improperly. And that's his contention, and I won't try to explain all of his reasoning, but I encourage you to take a look at that book if you're most interested. Now, today, about the top 1% of our wage earners pay nearly half of federal income taxes. Is that fair? A top 10% pay 68% of all of the federal income taxes. Is that fair? Well, a lot of people have contend that it is not fair. It is certainly not equitable for that kind of for 1% of our citizens to pay nearly half of all of the federal income taxes. Just on its face, not fair. So you've had now proposed two different basic replacements for our current tax system. Our tax system is 60,000 pages of instructions that only tax accountants and lawyers can understand. So it's clear that something needs to be done, and unfortunately we've had this problem for many, many years, scores of years, and nothing's been done about it. But there's two basic ideas that have been put forward, and each of them has been actually put into a proposed law. One of them called the fair tax and one of them called the flat tax. And each of those has a patron in Congress who has put this together in terms of a proposed law. Unfortunately, neither one has gained much traction. The primary reason being that the American people have not insisted on a replacement. Until the American people insist that something be done, nothing is really going to be done. But let's take a quick look at both those proposals and see what is involved. Of course, a flat tax is what we did have. In 1861, we had a flat tax. 2% of all income above $800 was the tax. Everybody who made more than $800 that year was taxed at 2%. That's a flat tax. And a flat tax today would look something like that. It would be a single rate that everyone would be subject to. Now, what is the rate? Well, there's various proposals as to in terms of what the rate would be: 10% rate, 17% rate. Different percentages have been proposed, and then you have the question of what are you going to tax? Is it going to be wages only? Is it going to be income from other sources? So all those details still need to be worked out, and that's why there's a lot of, questions about whether this is a good idea or not. So, but a flat tax is used in 24 countries around the world. It's nothing new. 24 countries have decided they don't want a progressive income tax such as we have, and they have replaced it, or they have initiated a flat tax. So that's one idea. The other idea is what's called a fair tax. Now, there's a whole organization that's proposing the fair tax. In fact, I communicated with them to see if they want to come on this show and explain their fair tax proposal, and I never got a reply. So anyway, take that for what it's worth. But a fair tax would replace our income tax with some sort of a national sales tax. In other words, nobody individually would be paying to the IRS every every April 15th. They would be paying all year round through sales tax that would be on all goods, some sort of a sales tax or some percentage. And again, this percentage would have to be worked out and negotiated and agreed to. But the fair tax then is kind of an unseen tax because you'd be paying this with every product. Now, the idea is, well, we don't want to tax people for their necessities, and people certainly at the poverty level would be unfairly affected by this. So part of the fair tax proposal is what's called a prebate, wherein everybody who's paying taxes would get a monthly check from the government that would offset the sales tax that they're going to be paying on necessities such as food and clothing, etc. So that becomes rather complicated and begs the question of what is the proper prebate level, and then you need a administrative agency, still something like the IRS, to handle and process all these prebate checks, make sure they get to the right people on time. So that's a rather complicated system that's been proposed, a fair tax idea. David, if you were had to pick one or the other, fair tax or flat tax, and that was the only two choices I'm going to give you, which do you think is the better way to go?
Well, let me state first that I don't believe either of them are constitutional in this regard. Unless we amend the Constitution, and the 16th Amendment did not accomplish the amendment that would either allow a fair tax or a flat tax, we need to allow the states to tax their people and send the check or the bill that's received from the federal government. The states determine how that's to be raised. And the reason our founders designed it that way, I believe, is because they realized you have a far greater influence and a far greater power over your state legislators who are going to choose the form of taxation that you're going to be subject to that winds up paying the federal tax bill. In addition, before the 17th Amendment, the states appointed their legislators, the state legislature appointed their senators, which means they had a direct control, and the idea was that the states, as legislatures, were represented at the federal level in the Senate by their two senators, and any time their senators did not do what the state legislators wanted them to do, they could recall those state legislators or state senators at a moment and replace them with anyone they wanted, which means each state had a check upon the spending power of the federal government. When the federal budget was being considered, and we know that they voted last night to continue resolution and on the spending and raise the debt ceiling, all that sort of stuff, that could only happen with the permission of the state legislators, who would say, yes, we are fine with you going spending some ridiculous amount of money to study snail darters or whatever it is, and we know that we're going to have to answer to our people in our state that we're going to have to tax them to study snail darters, and they're going to be questioning us. You have far more power to fire your state legislator if they're going to tax you for ridiculous things than you ever do to control anyone in Congress. And by the way, Congress does a terrible job of any control over the IRS, which is quite evident. The IRS does whatever they please. They're a rogue agency. So I would argue never give any additional taxing power to the federal government. Eliminate that entire system. Go back to the tax bill coming to the state governments proportioned based upon the census. We need to repeal the 17th Amendment while we're at it, by the way, so that the states will have a direct say in the federal budget, because those states are going to have to raise that money out of the blood, sweat, and tears of their own people. And the people, if they don't like either the spending that the state legislature has agreed with at the federal level, or if the people of the state don't like the method by which their state is raising the taxes, in other words, they prefer a fair tax or a flat tax or whatever, some other system of taxation, the states can easily fire their state legislators and put people in power in their state governments to do the will of the people regarding the way in which they are going to be taxed to pay the federal tax bill. So I know that's not the two answers you wanted from me, or one of the other. I kind of avoided that, but I see the whole thing, and I've actually spoken at one of the fair tax movement gatherings, and I said my proposal would be a return to a constitutional form of taxation, which we have not had now since the false interpretation of the 16th Amendment has gone through. And that false interpretation, by the way, wasn't immediate. The Supreme Court clearly said there's no new taxing powers. Citizens are not going to be taxed directly. Capitation still, the restrictions on capitation are still in place. But all that changed with a little war, you know, World War II. It's like, oh, your patriotic duty. You know, we need to tax you on your income to pay for the war. And everybody, you know, in the great patriotic surge, said, oh, yes, of course. And, of course, the promise was, well, when World War II is over, we're going to end that income tax. It's just a war measure. You know, war requires it. It's necessary. Well, lo and behold, World War II ended, and peace treaties were signed, and the tax continued. Sounds like somebody was lied to about the nature of this income tax. So we need to return if we can, and I believe we can, if the states rise up in mass and say, we will not allow the IRS to do business in our state any longer. And by the way, there's, you know, been states who proposed legislation. It has not yet passed both houses and so on, but proposed legislation to say the IRS is out of business in our state. Georgia was one such state. I think the 10th Amendment Center still tracks these kind of bills, but it would basically say when you write your check out, April 15th, don't write it to the IRS. Write it to the Treasury of the state of Georgia, and Georgia will indemnify you against any attack from the federal government. When you do so, Georgia is going to gather all the receipts from all the people, all the payments from all the people in its state, and then it's going to look at the federal budget, determine what percentage of the federal budget is actually constitutional, and forward that percentage of proceeds to the federal government, which, you know, there's maybe a little problem there in terms of their interpretation of the Constitution, but at least attempting to return the taxing power to the state out of the hands of the IRS and out of the hands of the federal government and return it to the constitutional limits that our Constitution guarantees to us and that are still the supreme law of the land. And the proper interpretation is still what the 16th Amendment meant when it was ratified, not when it was reinterpreted at the time of World War II and subsequently misinterpreted since World War II.
Well, so you would have to choose either flat tax or fair tax at this time. You would basically leave that choice to the states, and they could put in place whichever method they think is the best way to collect that tax, and then repeal the 16th and the 17th Amendments and go back to the original constitutional provision of taxation by assessing the states for a proportional amount and do it that way. So, I like that. There's some great ideas there. Now, repealing the 16th and the 17th we could talk about that for a long time. That would take us down quite a rabbit hole in terms of how you're going to repeal the 16th and 17th. Are you going to wait on Congress to do it or use a convention of the states to force Congress's hand in that regard? Now, we've got one caller on the line, Claude Dunn from Fredericksburg, Virginia. Let's bring Claude on and see what Claude's question or comment is. Claude, how are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. About Saul?
We're doing fine.
Good. The reason I call, I think need to go back to the start of your conversation as to what is the proper taxing for government, period. And while we certainly have the Article 1, Section 8, those things there, I think even before that we go back to the Declaration of Independence that clearly states that the purpose of government is to secure our God-given rights, and therefore that's the purpose of government. Then the purpose of taxation is to fund the securing of our God-given rights. If anything goes beyond that, then it could not be constitutional to do so. No, they,
well, right.
They
so yeah,
didn't.
We agree that there has to be a taxing power, and there
right.
is a purpose,
there has to be a
legitimate
power.
Purpose for that.
But again,
the
going to Article
becomes,
1, Section 8, as you're well aware of, the different clauses there are broken into general warfare clauses and common defense clauses. So the first few clauses deal with the general welfare, and the last deal with the common defense. So
right.
again, the powers, to collect for general welfare is actually specified. It's not anything that you want to deem as general welfare. It's these particular clauses in Article 1, Section 8. And the same
right,
thing
but the
with
Supreme,
the defense.
Clause, you know as well as I, the Supreme Court has turned the general welfare clause into an omnibus grant of power. They can,
right,
they can
but that again goes away from
purpose
the confines of the Declaration of Independence, the confines of any reasonable understanding from the Founding Fathers' perspective of when we wrote and ratified the contract between we the people and our representatives in government. It doesn't mean what it meant at the time it was written, then it's really not a valid contract.
Well, sure. So then what you're supposing is that without a contract, we have no government. Now, let me bring up
well,
another
Well, that's what we're
interesting...
fighting today is, of course, getting back to the original understanding, and that's the overall problem. But I'm just saying, initially, we need to realize what is proper taxation. What government does, it does by the force of law, and therefore, we are delegated it our rightful use of force. We have a right of to use force to protect our life, liberty, and property. And government can certainly tax us to pay for those expenses incurred to protect our life, liberty, and property. But taxation to do anything beyond that is unconstitutional. That's that's like the Ten Commandments. You got the Ten Commandments, but the Lord reduced them to two. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. So this is a simplification of the Article 1, Section 8 that specifies as the general welfare and common defense. It's just if you cannot tax beyond protecting our God-given rights. That's the only time we have a right to use force. It's the only time government has a right to use force. That's the only thing government should be used for, is
right.
protect
and
our
so
God-given
we need
rights.
To get the American, we need to get the American people talking with their representatives and explaining this to them because they clearly don't understand it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so we need more educational programs like the Institute on the Constitution is operating, and like I'm doing with my seminars, and in about 150 years we'll have everybody educated.
Well, that score should go on in public school if there was such a thing as a public school.
Yeah, right.
That's a whole different.
So yes, we have a monumental problem, and education is at the root of it. But we're not going to get there from here at the rate we're educating people. So there must be some other mechanisms employed.
To start off with, you need to go back to the fundamentals and understand that the fundamental principle based on the Declaration of Independence and the expansion of that, what's actually constitutional in the Constitution, and that needs to start our conversation. We're so
right.
far beyond that today, it's pathetic and... putting it back on the state control would certainly be a step in the right direction.
Well, you're certainly hinting, though, at civil disobedience. If this is an unconstitutional environment we are operating in right now, then the people have an obligation, according to Jefferson and the Declaration, to set things aright. And what is the best method for doing that? I want to bring in another book, one that I've just gotten halfway through, Charles Murray, wrote a book called By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission. And he has some really good ideas. And the first half of the book shows you just how bad things really are and how imperative it is that we wrestle with this. But then how do we correct things? And we talked about education. We talked about people talking with their representatives and explain the problem and how something has to be done. There's different proposals for different tax ideas out there. David's talked about bringing them back to the state level for the states to administer. But how do you bring these things about? And Charles Murray's idea is that there has to be a rising level of civil disobedience in this country, not violent, peaceful, of course, and you choose your targets very purposefully, as he lays out in his book. And I think it's a very important book that people should get a copy of and read, because he has some great ideas, and he shows you just how futile it is to maybe work within the system, as we are typically encouraged to do. And we have to get the attention of our representatives somehow, and perhaps massive civil disobedience is the way to do that. Henry David Thoreau, I think, would subscribe to that. David, what do you think?
Agreed. I've read a portion of his book, and I really appreciate, I haven't finished it yet, but appreciate what he's saying, basically throwing monkey wrenches into the administrative workings that will essentially shut down, because it really is voluntary compliance. And if everybody stopped volunteering to comply, there wouldn't be enough prisons, enough police, and so forth to arrest everybody and imprison everybody. They could not do that, but it takes a massive movement, I guess I would say, to accomplish that, where it seems that our founders only had 2 to 3% of the people really on their side initially when they began to stand against King George III. So perhaps, you know, Charles Murray's ideas will catch fire, because if the American people are fed up, and many of them certainly are, I meet them every week, people all over the country who are fed up with our federal government, disgusted by it, and my contention is the more local level that resistance can be organized at, the better, so that at a county level, if you have a proper constitutional sheriff who will defend you, who will protect you from the federal tyrants, which is really what we need to understand the battle is against the federal tyrants, so you need local organization to protect you, because if you do decide to resist the IRS, you know what's going to happen. They're going to come take your bank account. They're going to come take your house, take your car, take everything that you own, even if there is no court judgment against you, just that the IRS says, we think you're not in compliance, you're toast, unless you have a sheriff who is willing to protect you from that kind of overreach on the part of a vastly out-of-control IRS. So I'm going to finish reading Charles Murray's book. It's fascinating. Actually, I've sent a letter to him asking him if there might be some way that Institute on the Constitution can participate in the movement that he is gathering and help educate Americans and then give them a particular plan of action that will be effective in stopping the federal tyranny, kind of a modern-day Tea Party where we find which harbor to throw the tea into today.
Well, that's great. I hope you're successful with Mr. Murray. We've only got about a minute left here, and so we don't have time for more calls, but I want to thank Claude for calling in and giving us those thoughts. It is a, you know, we face a really terrible situation in this country, and something has to be done. We've got to get the people's attention, and there are many different remedies that need to be employed. Not one of them is going to solve all of our problems. So there's a lot to be done, and a lot of people needed to be employed in this doing. But let's go back to that that quote of Thomas Jefferson from the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. To compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. So if you're not happy contributing your hard-earned money to your federal government and seeing the way they use it, then you need to talk to your representatives. I hope you join us next week on We the People, the Constitution Matters, because it does matter, and so do you. So we'll see you next week. Bring a friend to the discussion.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts.
just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.